There, Madrigal says. That's enough. Arsinoe presses a cloth to staunch the bleeding. Do you have anything to eat? She asks, and Madrigal tosses her a sack. Inside is a skin of cider and some strips of dried meat. She eats, but the bloodletting does not really bother her anymore. Her arms and hands are so covered in scars that she has not been able to roll up her sleeves all season. Madrigal bends slowly down over the small fire she built when they arrived. She is not more than 2 months pregnant, but already her belly shows. Do you hope for a girl? Arsinoe asks. I hope for you to focus, Madrigal says and blows on the flames. But if you had to choose... Madrigal looks up at her wearily. She has never seemed less enthusiastic about performing low magic. The child saps her strength. It doesn't matter. She sits back on a log. The Malones whelp only girls, but the Sandrins only boys. Her hand passes over her stomach. So we will have to wait and see whose blood will out. A wind, cold for this time of year, sweeps through the clearing, and the old tree's leaves hiss like snakes. The other queens are coming, Madrigal says, inhaling the breeze. If you want to curse your sisters, we must do it now. Arsinoe nods. A memory rises of little Katarine, with daisies in her hair. Of Mirabella, holding her tight when the priestesses tried to kill her when she washed ashore at Innisfool. She pushes them away. She has to concentrate. More than half of a curse is about intent. Does Joeyenne know you asked me to help you? Madrigal asks. Yes. And she didn't try to stop you. For someone who wants me to focus, you sure seem distracted. What will this curse do, anyway? Arsinoe asks.
I don't know.
What do you mean? This is not the same as a rune or a charm, Madrigal replies. A curse is a force sent out into the world, and once you set it loose, you can't call it back. Whatever passes through this smoke today will bear your will, and the goddess's will, but it will also wield its own. Low magic always wields its own will. Is that why it went out, that day into the storm, to cast a net around Joseph and Mirabella? The cuts on her arm throb, and she feels the weight of some price she cannot yet dream of. Madrigal pours Arsinoe's blood into the fire. The flames seem to jump at it, lapping it up, eating it without sound or sizzle. She pours it all, and feeds it higher with cords soaked from past bloodlettings. Her murmurs are the same as murmurs to her unborn child. Behind her, the bent-over tree creaks, and Arsinoe stiffens. But that is foolish. It cannot move. It will not wake and pull itself free of its roots. Think of them, Madrigal says. Arsinoe does. She thinks of a little girl, laughing and splashing in the stream. She remembers Mirabella, stern and ready to wade in if she fell. I love them, she realizes. I love them both. Madrigal, stop! Stop? Madrigal asks and breaks eye contact with the flames. The fire rises in a wave and reaches for Madrigal. Arsinoe shouts and leaps to press her to the ground, smothering the flames with the sleeves of her shirt. In an instant it is out, down to only smoke. But the stench of burned hair and skin is thick. Madrigal! Madrigal, can you hear me? Arsinoe takes Madrigal's shaken face between her hands. Her shoulder was burned down deep, blackened, the red of flesh exposed. But Madrigal does not seem to notice. My baby, she murmurs. My baby. What? Madrigal's stomach is unharmed. And she did not fall hard, the baby is fine. Madrigal! She brushes tears away from Madrigal's cheeks. My baby! My baby! Her cries grow and the corners of her mouth twist down. My baby! Madrigal! Arsinoe slaps her. Just a little bit. Nowhere near as hard as Kate, even when Kate is playing. And Madrigal's eyes jerk left and fix upon her face. The empty jar of Arsinoe's blood, coated red, falls from Madrigal's hand and rolls across the ground. Arsinoe dares a look back at the bent-over tree. It stands in its place, trying to seem innocent. "What happened?" Arsinoe asks. "Nothing," Madrigal says.
"Madrigal, what did you see?"
"I saw nothing," Madrigal snaps, wiping quickly at her face. "It was not about you, and it wasn't real." She stands up, her arms protectively across her belly. It was about the child. Arsinoe knows that much. And whatever it was awful. Arsinoe looks again at the tree, at the sacred space. Low magic does not do only what one intends, but nor does it speak in falsehoods. The bent-over tree does not lie, and a spike of fear hits Arsinoe in the gut, for Madrigal and her baby, for Jules and the little sister or brother she will love so well. "You're right," Arsinoe soothes her. "It was my fault. I couldn't concentrate. I kept seeing images of my sisters. Memories. We can try again."
"We can't try again."
Madrigal shakes loose and runs from the clearing. She does not stop when Arsinoe calls after her. Arsinoe looks down at the ashes of the fire, already cold. She could try again by herself, but somehow she knows that it would do no good. Midsummer is here, and she will have no more advantages than the secrets she has already been given. "The other queens are coming," Arsinoe says to the tree, "and it seems that you want them here." Midsummer. The Valleywood Road. Riding near the head of the Indrid Down caravan, Catarine lifts her nose to the breeze and inhales deeply. It is not far to Wolf Spring. She can almost smell the fish market. Theirs is said to be the finest catch on the entire island, and she hopes so, for Natalia has been craving a poison reef fish.
"Will you tell me more about the Midsummer Festival?"
Nicholas asks. He and Peter ride up on either side of her, so close that Half Moon snorts at the lack of space.
"I understand there are to be feasting and lights." "Lanterns burned into the harbor," Peter interjects, "and ample opportunity for poisoning. Wolf Spring is notorious for drunkards. There will be confusion and movement, and Arsinoe will not dare use the bear in the midst of so many of her people."
He glares across the saddle at Nicholas, and Catarine has to bite the inside of her cheek to keep from laughing.
"The bear does not frighten me," she says. "I have brought something special for him."
At that, Nicholas smiles. Catarine has brought long, sharp pikes, perfect for skewering through the hide of a bear. He looked over them with great approval before they departed from Greavesdrake.
"Tell me more about the queens, then, whom you will face. A naturalist and an elemental. Is it always so? I had heard of other queens. Oracle queens and war queens."
"There has not been an oracle queen for ages," says Catarine. "Not since one went mad on the throne and ordered the execution of several of the families on her council. She said they were plotting against her, or rather, that they would plot against her in the future. She said that she foresaw it. Now when a queen is born with the sight gift, we drown them."
She expects him to pale. Instead, he nods.
"Madness in a ruler is not to be born. But what of the war gift? Why is there no war queen?"
"No one knows why the war gift has weakened. The drowned queens explain why the Oracle City of Sunpool has nearly emptied. But Bastion remains. The war gifted remain. Yet there has not been a queen born with the war gift in generations."
"A shame," says Nicholas. "Though you, sweet Catarine, are warlike enough for me."
He grins. Such a suitor she has attracted. He is refined and charming,
but he craves blood. He says she is too bold to poison from a plate, that she is too skilled with knives and arrows to let that skill go to waste. When he said so, she nearly kissed him. She nearly pushed him to the ground. Natalia wants her to take Billy Chatworth as her king consort, to preserve the alliance between their families. But when the suitors engage in the hunt of the stags, a sacred hunt, open only to them, Billy Chatworth will not stand a chance. Nicholas will hunt him as he hunts the stag, and then Catherine will be free to choose him. Calls from the lead guard make their way down the line.
We are nearly there, says Peter. It is just around the next bend.
Then let us ride to the front. Catherine puts her heels to Half-Moon's sides before Peter can protest, and Nicholas laughs as he races along behind her. As she crests the gradual curve that leads into Wolf Spring, salty sea air rises like a wall and rushes against her chest. They do not slow until they reach the outskirts of the town. As expected, it is not much to look at, buildings of graying wood and signs bearing faded paint. But the people on the streets and in the shop windows stop what they are doing to stare, their gazes slightly hostile and very wary. When the rest of the coaches arrive, most seem relieved to be able to look away.
You do not even know where we are riding to,
Peter says angrily when he catches up.
Truly, Renard, Nicholas says. There is the town and there is the sea. How are we supposed to get lost?
Catherine chuckles. It is true. She does not know why it was necessary to have Cousin Lucian and giftless Renata Hargrove leave a week in advance to select their lodging. In a city this size, there could not have been more than 4 or 5 choices.
Where are we staying, Peter? She asks.
The Wolverton Inn, he replies. The lead coach knows the way, if only you will follow it.
Catherine sighs. Very well. She slows Half-Moon so the rest of their party may catch up and adjusts the weight of the poison knives affixed to her hip. She lifts her chin as they ride through the streets, past the salt-hardened, hateful people. It is not much of a welcome, but she and her knives will have such a lovely time here.
Wolf Spring. As the Queen's arrivals ripple through the town like a current, Wolf Spring comes alive. Workers pound wood and planks as they erect new viewing platforms to overlook the harbor. The Wolverton Inn and the Bay Street Hotel ready accommodations for their guests. Shopkeepers stay open a few hours later and find chores to do outside, hoping to catch a glimpse of the undead poisoner, or Mirabella, the legendary elemental. According to Ellis, who has been their eyes and ears in town since the other queens arrived, even Luke stayed out late, sweeping the walk in front of the bookshop, though he did take Arsinoe's crowning gown out of the window first.
We should have refused this, Jules says.
We couldn't, Arsinoe replies. Catherine and the Aarons have already made themselves at home in their rooms at the Wolverton Inn, no doubt driving poor Mrs. Castile and her young Miles half out of their minds with crazy poisoner demands. And to the west, the Temple Hill swarms with Roland priestesses as they attempt to make the modest quarters of rounded stone fit to house Queen Mirabella.
It's monstrous, setting us up this way, Arsinoe says, like pieces on a game board.
If it's the goddess, then she is cruel. And if it's the council and the temple, then we're fools for dancing to their tune.
Maybe so, Jules says. But like you said, we couldn't refuse.
Why can't we just stay here? I want to live our lives here the way we always have.
From the corner of her eye, Arsinoe sees Jules clench her fists and glances nervously at the trees to see if they will shake.
What about our happy ending? Jules asks. Isn't that worth fighting for?
But when Arsinoe does not answer, she snaps.
Stop being such a child. If you win, you get to live, and that's better than nothing.
Arsinoe flinches,
I wasn't going to hit you, Jules says. Not any harder than usual. Not because of this curse.
I'm sorry, Jules. You just startled me is all.
Sure, Jules says, unconvinced.
Sure.
Is it getting worse? Arsinoe asks. But they do not even know what worse is. The war gift growing stronger? Jules's temper? Jules going mad?
I'm fine. Jules takes a long, slow breath. I wish it had gone better with you and Madrigal at the tree.
They have helped Madrigal nurse the burns. With Kate's good salve, they will hardly scar. But she refuses to say what she saw in the flames about her child.
I guess we'll have the advantages we have, Arsinoe says.
Why aren't you afraid? Why won't you fight for yourself?
Of course I'm afraid, but I can only do what I can do, Jules.
For a long time, Jules is silent, and Arsinoe thinks it is over. But then Camden snarls, and the logs from the woodpile begin to shift and tremble.
We'll keep you safe just to spite you, Arsinoe, Jules says darkly. Camden, Joseph, and I.
You mean to use your war gift?
You can't. If they see that, they'll...
Arsinoe pauses and drops her voice low as if the council might already be listening.
They'll take you back to Indrid Down and lock you up. They'll kill you. The island doesn't trifle with madness.
Maybe I won't go mad.
Maybe it should be unbound, and this is why I have it. To protect you when you won't protect yourself. I don't want you in this, Jules. Please.
This is your life.
Don't tell me to stay out of it.
Jules glares at her hard and stalks away down the drive.
Jules?
I'm just going to find Joseph, she says over her shoulder. She slows and her voice softens.
Don't worry. We'll only keep an eye on what the errands and the temples are up to.
Arsinoe escapes for a few moments alone with Braddock beside Dogwood Pond before the chaos begins. But moments alone are not to be. Billy surprises her, returned from Roland.
Arsinoe, he says.
Junior!
Her whole body jerks toward him. She leaps at him and throws her arms around his neck. His hands press into her back, along with something else that rustles.
This is a better welcome than I expected, he says.
Then don't ruin it by talking.
Billy laughs, and they draw apart. He looks unchanged, unscarred by poison, safe and back home with her where he belongs. Her eyes move over his face, his shoulders and chest. Before she blushes, she looks at his hands.
Junior, she says, you have a wreath.
And a lovely one, too. Whip-smooth vines curled round and round, twisted through with purple butterwort and blue-eyed grass.
I made it. He holds it out. For you.
Arsinoe takes it and turns it over between her fingers.
I mean, I didn't make it, he amends. But I told the girl from the market what to put in it. It's not meant to be like a bouquet, he adds hastily. I know you're not the type. Naturalist or not.
But you brought me a bouquet once, remember? Last winter, after we were attacked by the old sick bear.
Those were from my father.
Arsinoe smirks. She slides her finger over the bit of pale blue ribbon attached to the wreath, used to hang it on a door in the days before the festival.
This is very nice, she says, with an uncharacteristic lack of sarcasm. It will be the first one I release onto the water.
Then she laughs when Braddock comes to inspect it, sniffing and sniffing with his large brown nose.
Will he be with you at the festival? Billy asks, reaching down to scratch him between the ears.
Yes, but I'll keep him near the docks, away from most of the crowds.
Will he be safe, though? So near the other queens. After what happened at Beltane?
I think it will be fine.
She forgets sometimes that Billy witnessed the attack at the Quickening. He is so at ease with Braddock now, ruffling his fur and cooing to him like a kitten.
You spoiled bear.
Arsinoe pats Braddock on the shoulder, and he waddles away, his coat as glossy a great brown's as she has ever seen. Wolf Spring has made him fat and sleek, well-fed on only the best of the catch.
Tell me you have a plan, says Billy. Some weapon or action that no one knows about.
I have a bear. Some would say that's enough.
She looks down at her wreath. Do we have to talk about this? You've only just returned.
Just returned, he echoes, as part of Mirabella's entourage.
This stupid festival. His being back is the only good to come out of it. She turns toward him and touches his neck. I'm glad to see you're all right. Luke's tailor friends told us horrible stories of poison in Rolinth, disfigured priestesses, poisoned livestock. Was any of it true?
Billy nods.
He says no more, but he seems so haunted suddenly that she knows it must have been, and worse.
I should have written, he says, but truly there was nothing to tell, and anything I wanted to say I couldn't get down.
We are both that way. I can never find words that don't sound stupid on paper.
Jules can write for days.
We must always be sure to come face to face then, so there are never any misunderstandings.
He runs his fingers along the edge of her mask, down to her jawline, where the smallest bit of scar shows from behind the lacquered wood.
I don't know how much I'll get to see you, he says.
Aren't you staying with the Sandrins?
Even in Wolf Spring, I'm still Mirabella's official taster. I will have to stand beside her during the festival ceremonies.
Arsinoe's throat tightens. To see Billy standing behind her sister will hurt, even if it is only for show.
So you won't do what you did at Beltane? Leave Mirabella and come to me?
Things are different now, he says quietly.
How different? Billy takes her by the shoulders, and she holds her breath. There is no poison on her lips this time. If he kisses her, she will kiss him back. She will never let him go.
But instead, he crushes her to his chest.
Arsinoe, he says,
and kisses her hair and her shoulder, everywhere but where she wants.
Arsinoe, Arsinoe.
I hope we can talk once more, at least, she says. She buries her nose in his shoulder.
Before one of my sisters gets to me.
Don't say things like that.
For her part, Mirabella has no particular plan here except to stay alive.
Or you just don't know of one, Arsinoe counters, drawing back.
Would you tell me, Junior, if you did?
Would you tell her if you knew a plan of mine?
He looks away.
Don't answer, she says. They were unfair questions. Mirabella isn't just a name to you now or a face atop a cliff. I don't expect that you would hate her for me.
Billy takes her hand in his and threads their fingers together.
Perhaps not, he says, but I will never let anything happen to you, and that will never change.
Wolf Spring Temple.
Luca runs her finger along the windowsill in the temple cottage and holds it up to Ro.
It is clean, at least?
At least. Ro chuckles.
You have grown soft and spoiled as a cat, High Priestess.
Luca chuckles as well.
That is true enough. She has been the High Priestess for a long time and enjoyed all the trappings that came with it. If she sets all of that aside, the modest dwellings are perfectly sufficient. The Rolinth Priestesses have done a fine job cleaning and clearing out needed space. They could not say much about the security of the temple grounds, but Ro will take care of that. The difficult thing will be keeping Mirabella close. Already, Luca has seen her wandering the edges of the temple garden, eyes cast toward the town and the harbor. Their soft-hearted queen is curious about the life that her sister has led here, and she is yearning to see the boy, Joseph Sandrin.
I like it here, says Ro, inhaling deeply. It is harder than Roland, and more honest.
Such an assessment from one sniff of the air.
You know me, Luca. It does not take me long to have the measure of a place.
Nor of a person, Luca says. What do you make of this little poisoner? I did not think her a threat until she disappeared at Beltane and mysteriously returned.
So she dragged herself out of a pit. Ro curls her lip dismissively. She is still weak, propped up by the errands.
Luca walks to the eastward-facing window that overlooks the marketplace and the western harbor. It is a sunny, pretty day. Down in the city, people are busy outfitting a town square for their extra guests. Only the queens, their fosters, and the luckiest of the attendees will be able to fit there. The rest will spill out onto the side streets for the feast. Wolfspring, Roland, and Indrid Down mingling together.
Were we wrong to come here? Luca asks.
No.
Even though we cannot help her?
Ro places her hand firmly on the older woman's shoulder.
This is helping her. A young queen has only one purpose, and that is the crown.
I know you are right, Luca replies, but I still do not like it.
They celebrate with wreaths, Bree says as she twirls one around her finger.
This was made for you by the Wolfspring priestesses. They have made one for each of the queens.
She hands it to Mirabella. It is beautiful and expertly woven, comprised of some variety of blue wildflower, white lilies, and ivy.
I saw the one they made for Catarine. All dark red roses and thorns.
What do they do with them? Mirabella asks. But it is Elizabeth and not Bree who answers.
We float them onto the water, with paper lanterns at their center, she says.
Her face turned toward the harbor, a little wistful.
Does this place make you homesick, Elizabeth? Asks Mirabella.
Is it very much like Bernadine's Landing?
A little.
My home was not so near the sea. But all of that region bears similar scenery and the same traditions.
I did not see the bear when I was exploring town, Bree says abruptly, and Mirabella stiffens, though there was plenty of talk of it.
Where is she hiding it, do you think? And why?
Perhaps it is not safe. It was so brutal that night.
Is it that way for you, Elizabeth?
Does Pepper not always do exactly as he is told?
Elizabeth looks up into a nearby tree, and the tufted woodpecker cocks his head at her.
Pepper almost never does exactly as he's told, Elizabeth says and smiles. Our familiars know what we feel, and we know what they feel. We are joined, but we're each still ourselves. A familiar that strong, it may be hard to curb him when he's angry.
It does not matter, Mirabella says finally. We will see all of that bear that we want to and more during the festival.
Bree stands on tiptoe to look past Mirabella's shoulder.
What? Elizabeth asks.
Is there some handsome naturalist boy?
Bree's eyebrow raises, but then she pouts.
No, it is only Billy coming back from bringing his chicken to his fosters. Not that he is not perfectly handsome. If he were not a suitor...
She stops when Elizabeth throws an acorn at her. Billy said he was going to bring Harriet to the Sandrins for safekeeping, but Mirabella knows he will have gone to see Arsinoe.
I will be back, she says to Bree and Elizabeth.
Do not wander far.
I will not.
She could not, with so many priestesses watching.
She jogs until she reaches Billy and falls in step beside him.
He glances at her and then back at the ground.
Is this how it is, then? She asks after several moments. One visit to my sister, and we are no longer friends?
He stops at the crest of a hill and squints out at the sun sparkling off the ripples in Sealhead Cove.
I wish we weren't. When my father sent me to Roland, I swore that I would hate you, that I wouldn't be a fool like Joseph and get myself stuck in between.
He smiles at her sadly,
Why couldn't you be wretched? Don't you have any manners? You should have had the courtesy to be terrible, so I could despise you.
I am sorry. Shall I start now? Spit in your eye and kick you?
That sounds like something Arsinoe would do, actually. So I would find it endearing.
Did you tell her that I know the truth? Mirabella asks. That I know she did not try to kill me? Billy shakes his head, and inwardly Mirabella's heart aches. She wants Arsinoe to know. She wants to tell her so herself, and to shake Arsinoe by the shoulders until her teeth rattle for not telling her the truth about the bear that day in Ashburn Woods. Arsinoe would say that a lack of hatred does not change anything. But I think, Mirabella says slowly, that I could stand to die. If I knew that the sister who had to do it, if I knew that she loved me, she laughs at herself. Does that make any sense?
I don't know, says Billy. I suppose so. But I resent like hell that you and Arsinoe have to think that way.
He looks at her regretfully. I don't want to hate you after this, but I might. I might hate all of you if she dies. Mirabella gazes out at the sea. It is so pleasant here. In another life, things might have been different. Arsinoe would have greeted her when she rode into town and shown her the marketplace and the spots where she and Jules used to play as children. Do not be so quick to say after this, Mirabella says. We are here only for a festival. Perhaps nothing will happen at all.
Mirabella, Billy says softly, don't lie to yourself.
The Wolverton Inn. Genevieve has not stopped glaring in the direction of Wolfspring Temple since they set foot in their rooms at the inn. She paces and grumbles and crosses and uncrosses her arms. She is upset that Mirabella arrived in Wolfspring first. Catherine rolls her eyes as Genevieve stalks to the window. She cannot possibly see the temple. The inn is too deep in the heart of the town for that, no matter how hard she presses her nose to the glass.
Come away from there, Natalia says.
It is better to arrive last than in the middle.
There was no arriving first with Arsinoe already here.
Catherine ignores them as they prattle on about appearances and security. Like it matters at all. She slides the edge of a short throwing knife against a whetstone and listens to its scrape. Sharper, sharper. She will need them all in perfect condition, and a crossbow, and plenty of bolts besides. Cat, Natalia says, and in the corner of her eye, Catherine sees Genevieve stiffen at the sight of the knives.
What are you doing?
Getting ready.
Ready for what? Genevieve asks.
You do not need those. You are perfectly safe. Natalia, she says, ignoring Genevieve, what would you edge these with? She passes the tip of her finger across the blade, paper light. It cuts her skin so quickly that it does not hurt and takes a moment to bleed. I need something strong enough to take down a bear.
Do not fear the bear, says Genevieve.
I am not afraid of it. Catherine smiles. I have a plan. The Festival of Midsummer.
She is making a mistake.
Even so, Jules, it's her mistake to make. You can't push her.
Jules and Joseph are in his upstairs bedroom, studying the movements of Wolfspring through his window, using a long black-and-gold spyglass given to him by Billy's father.
Since when have I done anything but push her? Jules mutters. Arsinoe has always been mine to protect. I've known that since the moment I set eyes on her when we were children.
She looks through the spyglass. The streets are bustling, filled with people, and the festival is still hours away.
They'll blanket us from all sides, she says. Box us in.
At least we know the streets and the hiding places. We have the advantage.
This is a trap, Jules says. I don't think our advantages are going to matter.
Joseph looks down.
I've never heard you talk like this.
Then you haven't been listening. She closes her eyes. I'm sorry. That's unfair. It's just that we are surrounded by poisoners and elementals, and no one seems as afraid as they should be.
I'm afraid, he says, and takes her hand. I'm afraid for Arsinoe, and I'm afraid for you, Jules.
I know you'll say you don't need protecting, but I don't trust Madrigal. I think she might unbind you without your knowing. Maybe she already has.
Jules squeezes his fingers.
Poor Joseph. There are circles under his eyes, and he seems thinner. She had not noticed. My mother is trouble, but not that kind of trouble. She raises the spyglass back to her eye. And everybody needs protecting sometimes. In the market, there are so many white-robed priestesses that it looks like a raid. They are no doubt inspecting the food, though she does not know why. Mirabella will have brought her own. Any poison will have to be slipped into it by hand. The poisoners will strike at the feast. We can be sure of that. Arsinoe can't eat or touch a thing, and she can't be touched by strangers in case their skin is poisoned. Then they'll wonder why she doesn't die. Keeping the secret is nearly as bad as worrying about the poison. She curses and slams the spyglass shut between her hands.
Where is Arsinoe now?
Getting dressed. It'll take longer than usual. Midsummer is the one day out of the year that she lets Madrigal braid a flower into her hair. Joseph chuckles. I should get back, but I'm so tired. She rubs her temples. I'm so tired, Joseph.
Jules, this is not only your responsibility.
Kate will be busy helping with the ceremony. Ellis will help manage Braddock against the crowds. Madrigal is never any use.
Don't forget about Luke, says Joseph. And me. And Arsinoe herself. She's not helpless. And only one queen here really poses a threat.
A poisoned knife is still a knife, Jules says. It can still kill. She lets loose a shaky breath, and Camden comes to the edge of Joseph's bed to nuzzle against her knee.
You need to rest, he says. It could be a long night.
I can't. She shakes her head and turns as if to get up. What's happening in the square?
Joseph takes her arms and holds her fast. You can see it well enough from here. See? All the tables filling with paper lanterns ready to be released into the harbor. Just like any other year.
But it is not any other year. The blue sky above town is plumed with smoke as every kitchen prepares for the feast. And at the inn, and on the west hill of the temple, two other queens are waiting, searching for the chance to kill Arsinoe.
I said once that it was like you had never come back, Jules says.
That I wished you hadn't. I didn't mean it. I couldn't do this without you.
Joseph reaches out and pushes her hair off her cheek. I will always come home to you, Jules.
He wraps his arms around her and Jules holds on tight. She presses closer, but the tighter she holds him, the more she feels him slipping away. Joseph does not belong here anymore, and she does not know where she belongs.
Kiss me, Joseph, she says, but she is the one who leans in and pulls him close.
Her arms slide to his back, and she pulls at his shirt until it comes off. He tugs her shirt down off her shoulders, and they laugh when her hands get stuck.
I love you, Jules says.
She allows herself one moment where that is all that matters. Just Joseph and his hands on her shoulders. Just the touch of his fingers in her hair. She lies back on the bed and draws him down.
I love you, Jules. I'll love you for as long as I live.
Arsinoe tugs on the edge of her vest. She has worn the same one 100 times before, but today it feels all wrong, bunchy and ill-fitted. The mask on her face will not sit right either, no matter how she ties and reties the ribbon around the back of her head. It must be the braid. It hangs down the side of her head, itchy with oat stalk and flower petals. They braid something similar into her hair every midsummer,
even if she cuts her hair so short that the braid sticks out like a stiff, tiny arm. But it has never bothered her before. The day is wrong, not the braid. She finds Madrigal seated in the yard, in the shade, with Matthew resting beside her. "Have you seen Jules?" she asks.
"I haven't," Madrigal replies. "I thought she'd be here by now. We can't hold the processional forever."
Her shoulders droop, showing the bandage covering the burn that stretches across her collar and down her arm. She should be playfully putting her wreath of white snowdrops and grapevine atop Matthew's head. Instead, she sits, looking pale and thin everywhere but in the belly. Matthew reaches out and pulls Arsinoe to him. His sandrine smile is firmly affixed, charming and handsome enough to make her blush. So Madrigal must not have told him what she saw in the flames either.
"That's a pretty wreath," he says.
Arsinoe swings the temple wreath around her finger. "I've had prettier." She thinks of the one Billy gave to her. She had to give it to Kate when the temple priestesses arrived with the wreath of the naturalist queen, which is more bouquet than wreath, really. So many sprays of purple and yellow wildflowers that the paper lantern will have to be squeezed into the center. Back at the house, the side door slams and Kate walks toward them, with Eva perched on her shoulder.
"It's time."
"Already?" Arsinoe asks. "Won't we wait for Jules?"
"We can't wait any longer. As the hosts, we're expected to be first. Jules knows. I'm sure she'll meet us there."
Arsinoe exhales and calls Braddock as Madrigal and Kate step into their places ahead of her, with Matthew to the rear. Ellis walks up and squeezes her shoulder. "Stop," she says, and smiles at him shakily. "It feels like you're saying goodbye."
"Never," says Alice. "Just telling you I'm here, so you don't worry about Braddock."
Arsinoe nods. The fading wolf spring light is gentle and gold. "Odd," she says, "to feel so in danger on such a fine day." They begin to walk. All the way down, she cannot feel her legs. She just tries not to trip and keeps her left hand buried in Braddock's warm fur. By the time they arrive beside the cove, it is already full of people lining the docks and squeezing onto hastily assembled risers. High Priestess Luca stands at the water's edge with three priestesses, including Autumn, head priestess of the temple in Wolf Spring. When Luca sees Arsinoe, she inclines her head. There is no threat in the gesture, but Arsinoe's stomach quivers. She looks around anxiously for Jules, but Jules is nowhere to be seen. Mirabella walks stiffly with Billy, following behind Sarah and Bree. Today the Westwoods ignore that fact that he is only her official taster, and treat him like a true suitor. So far he has gone along with it, though he continually searches through the crowds for his Arsinoe. Sarah slows, and the line bunches together, so that Uncle Miles and Nico nearly run into Mirabella's heels. A good thing that her dress is short and has no train, or it would be covered in dirty footprints. Mirabella cranes her neck. The delay was caused by coming too close behind Katarine's processional, which is much longer and full of members of the Black Council. She cannot see more of Katarine than the back of her head, her hair loose, except for one small bun, pinned through with dark red blooms. She is arm in arm with her suitor, the handsome boy with the golden blonde hair. They begin to move again, and Mirabella's stomach hums with something like excitement. She is in Wolf Spring, where Arsinoe grew up, and somewhere near the water, Arsinoe waits. Only she will not be alone, or smiling, and she will have a bear. When they reach the shore, it is oddly silent. Mirabella expected glares from the poisoners, perhaps a little spit from naturalists. But there is nothing. No cheers or chatter. It does not feel at all like a festival. As they take their place, Billy tenses. Arsinoe is there, and when she looks at Billy, A blush creeps across her cheeks from behind her mask. Mirabella smiles to herself. There is no ill will today. Nothing will happen. Nothing more than pretty lanterns floating on the water and a barge full of fruit and grain to burn into the sea. Arsinoe's bear is calm, and Catarine seems interested only in her suitor, whispering in his ear so intimately that it is almost scandalous. The Black Council schemed and lobbied hard to bring them here together. Mirabella is glad that they will be so bitterly disappointed. Arsinoe looks across the shore at her sisters. It is the first time since the Black Cottage that she has been this close to both at once. Little Catarine has been overdone with makeup, in the Aaron fashion, but she no longer looks like a doll. Her chin is high, and her cheeks full. The barest hint of a smile plays at the corner of her lips. As for Mirabella, she is cold, as always. Her sisters are both queens, and know what they must do. "This is how it is," Arsinoe whispers. "Someone's going to die."
"They should have chosen somewhere else to hold the ceremony," says Nicholas. "Somewhere that does not smell like the inside of a clam shell."
The wind has changed direction, carrying with it the scents of the Wolf Spring marketplace. But Catarine does not mind. What little she has seen of Wolf Spring, she likes. The wilderness and a harbor full of rickety-looking fishing boats. They bob on the water and glow with paper lanterns in the blue light of dusk.
"The queens will come forward," the High Priestess says. And Catarine quiets as Luca holds her hand out to the naturalist. "Queen Arsinoe!"
Arsinoe walks to the water's edge, dressed not as a queen, but as a farmer, just like she was at Beltane. She receives a lit paper lantern from a Wolf Spring priestess and leans down to awkwardly push her wreath.
"Queen Catarine!"
Catarine takes her lantern from an Indra Down priestess. She places it in the center of her wreath and releases it, then smiles when her red roses bump Arsinoe's wildflowers out of the way.
"They do not mean for the High Priestess to present Mirabella's lantern," someone in the crowd mutters, as Catarine returns to her place.
But of course they do. Mirabella gets her lantern from Luca herself, along with a kiss on the forehead. The response from the poisoners is so strong that Catarine can nearly hear their teeth grinding. Mirabella releases her wreath, and in true show-off fashion, uses her gift to push all three out into the harbor. As if it is a sign, the boats drop their cargo of lanterns until the entire cove glows. One of the nearest boats tows a small barge, loaded with apples and bushels of wheat. It tows it out before the gathered crowd and cuts it free.
"The people of Rolanth bring an offering to honor the people of Wolf Spring," Mirabella says, "to thank them for welcoming us into their city."
Catarine pulls close the nearest servant.
"Get my bow, quickly, and the fire arrows."
The girl scarcely has time to nod before Catarine shoves her through the crowd.
"In Rolanth," Mirabella goes on, "this is how we celebrate Midsummer. I hope the naturalists will allow us this sacrifice in theirs and the goddess's honor."
Heads turn toward a tough-looking, gray-haired woman with a crow on her shoulder. She must be Kate Malone, the head of the Malone family, Arsinoe's fosters. Kate considers Mirabella's request for several long, tense moments before finally giving her permission with a subtle lift of her chin. She is hard, that woman. Perhaps even harder than Natalia. The people behind Catarine jostle and cluck as the servant girl returns with her longbow, threading it through bodies to get it to the queen.
"Very good," Catarine smiles. "Thank you."
"Cat," Peter says out of the corner of his mouth, "what are you up to?"
And then someone screams.
"Mira, she has a bow!"
Catarine rolls her eyes. It was that Westwood girl, the one who likes to play with fire. At the scream, the crowd shudders and collectively ducks. The priestesses drag Luca out of the way, even as the doddering old fool struggles against them, and the stupid Westwood girl runs down the bank. "Bree, no!" Mirabella cries. Catarine puts her hand on her hip. "Bree, no, indeed," she says. "I only mean to help." She steps to the center and turns toward the crowd. "My sister has put me to shame. I have brought no offering, but I can help her in the burning of hers." Catarine knocks the arrow and lights the head in the nearest lantern. The arrow burns prettily as she sights up into the darkening sky. When she draws back and shoots, it arcs out over the cove and strikes the barge dead center. The fire spreads, and the crowd awes with relief. Many clap softly, and not only poisoners. High Priestess Lucas scowls at Natalia, but when Catarine looks back, Natalia nods. Mirabella's moment has been thoroughly stolen. "This puts me in mind for something else," Catarine says loudly, looking at her bow. "I know there is a great feast awaiting us in the square, but we are in Wolf Spring, are we not? Home of the naturalists?" People in the crowd nod, their eyes filled with reflected flames from the burning barge. Mirabella and the High Priestess shrink backward, but there is nowhere to go but into the sea. "I have nothing to offer," Catarine half shouts. "No fine gifts. But I would still honor the naturalist queen." Her eyes settle on Arsinoe, petting her bear. The creature looks confused. Nothing to be afraid of, the poor thing. "Before we sit down to feast together, I would have Queen Arsinoe lead her sisters on a hunt." Arsinoe's stomach drops into her shoes. Everyone is cheering for Catarine's challenge, even her Wolf Spring people. The great, wild fools can never resist a hunt. And with her bear, they think she can win. They think the poisoner queen has made a fatal mistake. Amid the poisoners, a handsome boy with pale blonde hair whispers furiously into Catarine's ear, and Natalia Aaron and the Black Council shift on their feet. They did not plan this, but they cannot stop it now, and nor can the priestesses or the Westwoods. It is a challenge from one of the queens. It is why they came. Arsinoe stares straight ahead. She will not plead and make Kate and Ellis feel guilty when they cannot help. Soon enough, Kate's strong voice cuts through the din. "The hunt will commence in the northern woods, past the orchard. Make your queens ready." Out over the sea, the sun is setting. There is too much light left, too much to be able to wait for cover of dark, when Arsinoe's knowledge of the landscape could help her. She scans the crowd. Billy's eyes are full, as though she is already dead. Luke is praying, probably thanking the goddess for a sure victory. Arsinoe digs her fingers into Braddock's fur. "Jules," she whispers, "where are you?" The Queen's Hunt. Arsinoe runs from the gathering at the cove. Braddock jogs by her side and butts her with his head, the impact hard enough to send her nearly sprawling. She leans down to quickly kiss his ears. The sweet bear thinks it is only play. "Arsinoe!" She turns. Billy lingers at the bottom of the hill. He cannot follow. If only they had a moment to talk. He would try to tell her what to do. He could find Jules and Joseph, maybe act like a mainlander fool and make her angry enough to have a fighting chance. "Don't look so sad," she says, even though he is too far away to hear. "We both knew one of them would do something like this." Running probably seemed cowardly. Neither of her sisters ran. Mirabella scarcely could, surrounded by priestesses and Westwoods. And of course, Catarine would not. The little poisoner has been waiting for her chance, hatching a plan all on her own. "Arsinoe!" It is Luke, with Hank flapping on his shoulder.
I can't wait,
she shouts. She has to make it to the orchard and into the woods before her sisters, or it will be over before it begins. Katarine said that Arsinoe was to lead the hunt, but all that means is that Arsinoe will be the quarry.
Luke, stay out of the woods. Find Jules. Find Jules and Joseph.
The Westwoods and Luca stop Mirabella just west of the square. They form a wall of robes, and Bree, Sarah, and Elizabeth take her out of her midsummer dress and put her into her hunting clothes, leggings and light boots, a warm tunic and cloak.
Quickly, quickly, Luca orders breathlessly.
I need my crossbow, Bree says, and one for Elizabeth.
Bree, you cannot interfere.
I know that, but this is a hunt. Do you think the Poisoner Queen is going to charge into those woods by herself? She will have an entire Aran guard.
She is right, says Elizabeth. One of the priestesses hands her a weapon, and she hoists it in her good hand.
We will not interfere, but we won't let you face this alone.
Mirabella looks at Luca, but the High Priestess says nothing. Instead, Luca takes Bree and Elizabeth by the shoulders.
You good girls, she says. You loyal friends. Do not let our queen fall to treachery. If death finds her, it must come from a queen, and a queen alone.
Wait, Mirabella protests. Arsinoe does not know that she may have a guard. I saw her run off alone, and the Malones have not gone after her.
Good, says Sarah. An advantage.
But that is not fair.
Mira, Luca says as gently as she can. This was never going to be fair. Now, to the woods, over the hill to the orchard. Follow the Wolfspring priestesses.
Katarine, what have you done? Peter asks.
He puts his hands on both sides of his head as servants help Katarine out of her gown and into hunting clothes.
She is doing what she is meant to do, says Nicholas,
as he watches her change. Peter looks like he would break him in half.
You stay out of this, Peter barks. I have had enough of your mainlander ideas. You are a suitor, and not even her chosen one. You are not an Aran.
Katarine lets them bicker. The tension between them must overflow eventually. She just hopes she is there to see it when it does. If he has put ideas into my head, Peter, they are nowhere near as many as you have. Peter quiets. He glares at Nicholas. It is a good thing she is taking them with her on the hunt. Katarine slides her throwing knives into their sheaths and buckles them about her waist as Natalia sweeps into her room.
My sweet cat, you continue to surprise me.
This will be easier, Natalia. You will see.
She slides a longer knife into her boot.
It would have been chaos trying to poison at the dinner. So much sleight of hand and changing plates. You know, I have never been good at that.
You are a skilled archer, Cat, but I have never known you to be good at hunting. This is more risk than the council cares to take.
Be that as it may, they cannot stop it now.
Katarine gestures to a servant.
Crossbow and bolts dipped in winter rose, she orders,
referring to the Aran's favorite hunting poison.
No, we cannot, Natalia agrees.
The wait for your return will be long, with my sister and Renata in my ear.
Do not tarry. You must promise.
Katarine pauses. No one else can see what she can in Natalia's eyes. Natalia will never show fear or doubt, but they are there. Be careful and return to her, is what she means.
I promise, Natalia.
Good.
Natalia blinks, and the moment is gone.
Horseback, I think, is the best way. I have had Half Moon saddled, along with Peter's and Nicholas's horses. Bertrand Roman will join you, as well as Margaret Boleyn.
Margaret Boleyn? Peter asks, checking his own crossbow. From the council? The same, Natalia replies.